part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Ida Wells Barnett and Mother Jones are the two first profiles you will find in the new book, Lighting the Way, Nine Women Who Changed America. They were two women who were out to change the world at a time when women in America did not have the vote. In fact, none of the women profiled here in Lighting the Way have held public office. But the author of Lighting the Way, Karenna Gore-Schiff, says these women show us how much real political valor and power can be seen in the accomplishments of women outside the spotlight of elective office. The stories of the women in Lighting the Way provided Karenna Gore-Schiff with a way to look afresh at public service, leadership, and patriotism. The eldest daughter of Al and Tipper Gore, she began working on the book following the bruising presidential election of 2000. In the introduction to the book, Schiff says elected officials may keep politics grounded in public service, but she also says this, and these are her words, "The positive turns of American history have often come about through the unheralded efforts of those who took heart in dark days, guiding politics and politicians toward our nation's ideals." Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guest this afternoon, Karenna Gore-Schiff. You can join us with your questions and comments by giving us a phone call. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening outside the local dialing area, you may call toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Karenna Gore-Schiff, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. When you started on this book, did you have the title at the outset, and did you know at the outset you would focus on women who served others outside of public office?
Oh, I did know that I wanted to focus on women who were really consequential public servants and very much politically effective and yet weren't serving in office. I did not know the title, and in fact, I went through sort of several brainstorming sessions about the title, and I ended up with this one in part because I was thinking about the Statue of Liberty and the poem by Emma Lazarus, which is on it, and it's such a beautiful poem, the full poem, which I think we all know. We're more familiar with the last few stanzas, but it really, to me, it spoke to me about sort of the principle that what makes our country great is that anybody, no matter what their background, should have the opportunity to succeed, and all of these women fought for that.
Yeah. Well, also what I think is nice about the title is so often we don't see the person who is holding the torch. We just see the light that they lead us with.
Well, I think that's true. There are a lot of fascinating backstories to the major political movements and events of our nation, and I find them really interesting. I hope that readers will, too.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned Ida Wells Barnett and Mother Jones in my introduction, and I should mention the other women that are profiled here in Lighting the Way, some names that may be less familiar. Alice Hamilton, Frances Perkins, Virginia Durr, Septima Clark, Dolores Huerta, Helen Rodriguez Trias, and Gretchen Buchenholz. You want to give us some sense of the accomplishments of all these women, and can you tell us why they're not better known?
Well, I think that there are a few reasons why they're not better known. For one thing, they were working at a time when women were not considered for the conventional roles of authority. So often they would cede the credit to men. For instance, Frances Perkins, who was FDR's Secretary of Labor, obviously ceded the credit to him, and Dolores Huerta to Cesar Chavez, who was her partner in organizing farm workers. And another reason is that they were ahead of their time, so that Ida B. Wells Barnett, she brought one of the first legal challenges to segregation in 1883. She refused to give up her seat on a train car. And because that was so far ahead of her time, and because I suppose newspapers and contemporary press accounts are the first draft of history, she did not make it into the limelight. But they all did such incredible things, and I was so happy to be able to give voice to them again.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons, another reason you wrote this book, you say, was to illustrate how valuable the right to dissent is, how often the unpopular view is prescient, and how reactionaries use the same arguments over and over to block progress. How were the women you've profiled seen by the powers that were, the powers of their day?
Well, I was sort of stunned at the venom in the popular press towards some of them. For instance, for Ida B. Wells, when she was raising awareness about lynching, which was, you know, at the time just very commonplace torture and murder of black people throughout the South, she was really maligned by newspapers as well as by the leading business people and politicians in the South, and it was also true even going into later years. For instance, and a lot of these women, actually almost all of them, were tracked by the FBI. Several were thrown in jail. So mostly they encountered tremendous adversity from the powers that were in their day, and were called unpatriotic. And we look back and see that what they were doing, Social Security, women's rights, civil rights, environmental protection, public health, were really the major moral triumphs of the last century.
Hmm. How did they deal with being targeted as unpatriotic, or in Ida B. Wells' case, she was called the Black Harlot? How did they deal with that adversity, that name-calling?
Well, I think in a way it made them stronger. They really were all so savvy about the difference between image and truth, and they were standing up for people who were being kicked around, basically. So to have that happen to them didn't make them less determined. And I think that one thing that they all shared was this ability to turn setbacks, even devastating personal losses, really, into greater inner strength and conviction. And they all had tremendous empathy. I mean, they could relate to people of different backgrounds and wanted to reach out and help others.
Yeah, and it also seems that they were really, I don't know if they would call themselves patriots per se, but they were very concerned about their country and their countrymen.
Oh, absolutely. I think they were all motivated by a desire, they were all inspired by the founding principles, so that, you know, I think in some ways people could describe all of these women as progressive. But really, in my view, although I wouldn't argue with that, I think that they were also trying to make our country truer to its founding ideals. And they really achieved that, particularly at a time where it was sort of mass forces of industrialization and urbanization and immigration and the aftermath of slavery and the terrible racism. They were really there on the front line saying, you know, we have to really make our nation stand for equality and opportunity, and they achieved that.
Mm. Tell us about Alice Hamilton.
Well, Alice Hamilton, she was, in 1919, the first woman asked to join the faculty of Harvard University. And it was not because they wanted a woman. It was not a, it wasn't a token woman situation. In fact, they made two stipulations to her. They said, you can never participate in commencement, and you cannot have any football tickets. And but they asked her because she was such a pioneer in her field, which was industrial medicine, as she put it, meaning at the height of the Industrial Revolution, where there were so many new chemicals being used and workers being poisoned at a pretty fast clip, she made it her mission to go in and analyze the effects of these chemicals early on, discovering lead poisoning, mercury poisoning, among other things, and really made workplace safety and public health part of the consciousness, the political consciousness, at a time when it hadn't been.
Yeah. Well, you open the profile of Alice Hamilton with a statement that she made, and I don't know if you have the book with you, but it gets at what we were talking about a moment ago, about one's concern for one's country and fellow human beings. And I don't know if you'd care to read that for us, if you've got the book there. It's page 95, if you do have the book.
Oh, well, actually, I don't have it right immediately in front of me, but I can grab it quickly.
Well, why don't you do that, and I'll reintroduce you.
Okay, hold on.
How about that? Karenna Gorshiff is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Lighting the Way, Nine Women Who Changed Modern America. We're talking with Karenna Gorshiff this afternoon about leadership, public service, patriotism, and the women that she's profiled in her book, Lighting the Way, Nine Women Who Changed Modern America. Karenna Gorshiff has worked as a journalist, lawyer, and most recently as director of community affairs for the Association to Benefit Children. She is the oldest daughter of Al and Tipper Gore. Lighting the Way is her first book. It's a Miramax book published by Hyperion. And listeners, you can join us this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine with your questions or comments. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Do you have the book?
I do.
Great. Okay.
I'm here.
Yeah. I thought it was I did not know about Alice Hamilton before picking up Lighting the Way, and I really enjoyed all of the epigraphs that open the statements, but I was really struck by hers. You want to share it with us?
Sure. And incidentally, I did not know about her before I began this project. I did know about some of these women, but others I discovered in the process of my research, and she's one of my favorites as well. So the quote that I chose to open her chapter from her is as follows. Is it sensible to assume that what is American is necessarily wisest and best, or even that it is unchangeable? Surely we should have enough humility to reexamine our national ways and decide quite objectively if they are the best possible for us. Personally, I am very loath to accept the verdict that a dependence on the benevolence of the uppermost class toward the lowest class is the only possible American way of solving the problem of the poor, or even that it makes for a healthy state and contentment at the bottom of society.
Mm.
Alice Hamilton. I think reading that in context, she was working at a time when people were sort of defending as the free market. Sorry, you can probably hear the traffic outside my window in New York. People were defending as the free market just the total absence of safeguards in these new factories, and sort of saying, well, you know, in our country, because we're so powerful and strong, everything is going as it should, and people were being called traitors or un-American if they suggested that, for instance, fire escapes should be mandatory. And I think also she was speaking at a time when she was very concerned about international affairs. She was an early voice after World War One, when there was a blockade against Germany. She was an early voice saying that this was wrongheaded because the suffering in Germany, the starvation of children, among other things, was going to make the country more unstable. And she was called unpatriotic for that. And people said, oh, we don't want a pro-German person around. But in fact, we look back and see that she was absolutely right. And it did contribute to the rise of Hitler.
Mm. One of the things that I think is comes through in that statement of hers that you read is that she is saying, you know, in a way, she's saying, wait a minute, let's think about this. And I think that each of these women in their own ways, each of these nine women have done that very thing. That's one of the things that they have in common. What else do they have in common?
Well, I think that they did not covet credit or fame as much as they wanted to help others and make a difference. It's something Dolores Huerta called grace, or her mother, actually, because her mother told her, and it made a big impression on young Dolores. She said, when you see somebody who is in need, you should help them. But you shouldn't expect a reward for it, because if you do, then that takes away the grace. And I think that all of these women really acted in such a pure way, without trying to get into the spotlight and trying to take credit or reward. And then the other thing is that they were able to turn those to see opportunity where other people saw despair. And I think in some ways that's the most, for me, therapeutic aspect of this book. You can see how political obstacles can seem so insurmountable, and yet you look back, and these women all saw opportunity and were able to move things forward, while other people were sort of saying, throwing up their hands and saying, well, let's give up in the face of segregation or child labor or other situations like that.
Yeah. Talk with us, if you would, about how writing this book helped you personally put politics and public service into perspective after that election of 2000.
Well, I grew up around politics, and I've always just loved it. I mean, I more often than not, one of my first memories was actually when I was 3 years old, and I was with my father when he won his first political race, and my family on stage, a very tight election, actually. And it was my third birthday, and the crowd sang happy birthday to me, and I think that's probably why I remember it. It was sort of a shock. But more often than not, my exposure has been on that sort of level. It's a
positive, you know, one. Yeah.
A positive but very privileged vantage point, just a perspective on rallies and conventions and election nights. And I was so crushed by 2000. I mean, it was just it was obviously incredibly disappointing, and the way that we arrived at the outcome was especially so. And I was kind of drawn to that cynicism that I think is so pervasive about politics, particularly among younger generations, and I wanted to fight it. And I, all of these stories to me are about fighting that, because they're about reconnecting to what is so great about politics, and that is the real public service, the nitty-gritty, where the rubber meets the road. It's not about celebrity and spin and superficiality and who's ahead in the horse race. It really is about democracy and people coming together in our country to make us truer to our founding ideals. And so, to me, I came away with a lot more hope and optimism.
Do you think politics will be in your future?
Oh, I don't really. Well, absolutely. I want to lead a political life. I want to support candidates that I believe in. I want to advocate for issues that I care about. I do not know if I will run for office. I honestly have no plans to at the moment. But I certainly want to be involved in some way.
Hmm. I want to go back to the themes that come across in the stories of these nine women that you profile. And I've lifted these from the introduction, And I'll run them down, and maybe after each one that I mention, you could comment on them. Each of these women understood the power of public awareness.
Yes, and I think in some ways the fact that they were women encouraged them to do seek out this as a source of power, because they weren't considered for the more conventional roles of authority. They learned that making people aware in the country of serious injustice created a political opportunity. And I'll just give a couple of examples. First of all, with Mother Jones, she's probably the most radical woman in the book in some ways, but she really was about exposing and fighting child labor. And one thing that she did was she led a march of the mill children. And this was a time when it was 8- and 10-year-olds working in factories and mills and mines, being maimed and even killed. And she actually recruited hundreds of them to go on a march. And, of course, this she wasn't famous until her late 60s, actually. So this spectacle of this sort of little old lady Irish immigrant leading a march of children landed on the front pages of the paper and really did raise public consciousness about the issue. And then the last chapter of the book about Gretchen Buchenholz, who is a child advocate working now in New York, takes it into our current time. She snuck a crew from 60 Minutes into the welfare hotels of the 1980s in New York City, where homeless families were being housed, and it was really a terrible system because it was expensive and also quite inhumane. And so she actually this shocked the nation to see these images of young children among drug dealers and prostitutes and vermin and crime-ridden, dangerous situation. And that also led the way for change. So I think that it is something that all these women have in common and we're very savvy about.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Corinna Gore-Schiff, author of Lighting the Way, 9 Women Who Changed Modern America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question or comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line now and take a call from a listener in Eureka. Hi.
Hi. I'm enjoying this conversation. I think the goal of your book to re-energize, as I understand, to quote young people, which seems like most groups are always forever worrying about, is laudable. And I think during this time of a kind of, I would say, a malaise in progressive individuals across the country, my question is, what specific strategies do you see as being most effective in bringing that about?
I think that's a great question, and I struggle with the answer. Mm-hmm. And my role in the 2000 campaign was in part to energize young voters, and I feel as if I failed at that because we had. Still, in keeping with what it's been like for many election cycles, low turnout. And I think that in some ways it is about, and this is what I tried to accomplish in the book, reconnecting to substance. I really think that that young people are so suspicious now because it's the information revolution. We have all of these either real or manufactured scandals, and there's so much spin, and it's sort of, mm-hmm. it's hard to believe in anything because of that. But I think that when you look back, and I take great comfort in the past, and you see how really there are ways that individuals can join together in a political movement and make a difference. To me, I think that's inspiring. I take lessons. I like to find inspiration in the past. And I also think that when you look back and you see how hard previous generations fought
yes.
for the choices and freedoms that we enjoy, we owe it to them. And to carry on, to protect their gains and to move forward. So this is my small answer to that, but I wish I had a bigger one.
No, it's very good. May I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
If I ever remember something that sparked my excitement and I guess adrenaline was, do you remember the 1984 Mario Cuomo address to the Democratic Convention?
I do. I thought that was terrific.
I think that would be worth bringing back for Democrats because of all the things that I've ever heard people tell a political party about why they exist and what they should be about, I think that that one address, for me, was one of the highlights.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could sort of say the word and the deeds of his life maybe matched more than a lot more political rhetoric. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Others are invited, 333-9455. Anywhere else, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Do you think there's a bit of an identity crisis in terms of, the caller mentioned, you know, sort of saying what you're about? Do you think that there's a bit of an identity crisis in politics today?
Well, I think we're at a very strange time. I mean, I'm pretty young to judge it compared to anything else, but it's true that the hands that all branches of government are in the hands of one party. I mean, we have really concentrated power in one political party, and that party is leaning a bit to the right. I mean, we can see as now there are some Republicans even who are questioning the direction. So I don't know. I mean, it's I do think, and you can see in the past how this has happened, that if there is real sort of grassroots action and personal activity that builds on itself on other activity, and I mean things like going door to door and really sort of raising awareness. I mean, the environment is an issue where I feel like there could be a huge groundswell. Then maybe the pendulum will swing, and so I'm hoping to see that.
Well, that gets us to another one of the lessons or the themes of the nine women that you profile in Lighting the Way. All of these women believed in a grassroots approach.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and you can see that. Septima Clark is a great example. She was really a driving force behind the civil rights movement. Probably one of my biggest surprises, actually, in writing this book was that I had not heard of Septima Poinsett Clark before I began the project. She called it her first radical act, but her first experience with organizing was when she led a campaign to have black teachers hired in Charleston, South Carolina, in the public schools. At the time, even though the schools were segregated, black teachers weren't hired in the black schools. And so she went around with a croaker sack, as she called it, and collected signatures and she was knocking on doors, and she was lobbying, and later actually worked on a similar campaign with Thurgood Marshall, who went on to become the Supreme Court Justice, to get equal pay for black teachers. So this was really, for her, that illustrates grassroots political organization to me, and she went on to do that in the civil rights movement in a way that inspired many people who went on to vote, to run for office, to march, and created a real groundswell to make a difference.
Yeah, Rosa Parks was one of her students.
Yes, it was. I mean, I loved learning the backstory to that. Rosa Parks went. It was only months before she made her brave protest that changed history, that she went to one of Septima Clark's citizenship schools, and it was actually in rural Tennessee. And what it was an integrated workshop that trained civic leaders. It was also about literacy and voter registration, but also training people to go back into their communities and lead the way against segregation and for progress. And Rosa Parks went to Highlander and was in a workshop with Septima Clark. Months later, she changed history, and she said that it was Septima Clark who very much inspired her. And I think that it doesn't take anything away from Mrs. Parks. It makes the story, to me, even more colorful and interesting.
Yeah. Let's take another couple of calls here. Next, we go to Glenview, a listener on line 4. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question. How soon did you think it will be before we have a woman president?
I think that's... I really don't know, but I do think that the country is ready, much more ready than I hear. I think there's a lot of angst. It's one of these cases, I think, where there's a little bit more angst in kind of the political media than there is really in the country. Because, I mean, it's really healthy that in both political parties we have women being talked about as very viable potential presidents, and I think that that will increase as more women come up through the pipeline in both parties. So I'm hopeful that it will not be very, very long before we see a woman president, and I think it's a great testament also to a lot of the accomplishments of women of the previous generations.
I agree. I think the people are much more ready for it than what, like you were saying, what the media is trying to portray.
Great. Well, I mean, it's funny to think back and see how, you know, in lighting the way, some of these women were drafting legislation before they could vote. So, you know, Sometimes it's good to remind ourselves at how far we've come in a pretty short time. So,
let's talk with another listener. Caller, waiting for us on Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Very good topic here. I've got to get the book. Just to give you some background here, I work in corporate America. And I guess my question is, and I think one of the basic themes coming through is that these women basically cared about their mankind. And I find women that make it up the corporate ladder are not looking back and trying to pull others forward. And do you think economics will drive the kind of women that you wrote about out of the existence? You understand what I'm saying?
I do. I'm gonna try to respond, and you can tell me if I'm not responding to your exact question. I think it's a tough time for a lot of women in the workplace, particularly those who are in the period of time where it seems like make or break for your career, and often that's the exact same time where they're raising kids. And I think also because women have had such a hard time in the workplace in previous generations, there can be a feeling that, you know, they've suffered so much, and we have it so much easier, you know, as younger generations, that there's maybe less empathy at times than there should be. For the fact that that still women as primary caregivers to children are going through that same struggle. I think that what's really important is to recognize that. Well, first of all, let me say that one thing that I found really uplifting about choosing these stories in Lighting the Way is that a lot of these women made their strongest marks in their 60s and even in some cases beyond. And so I think it's good to kind of not focus too much on this narrow sliver of life. But I think the other point I wanted to make in response is just that there's so many women who are just really living hand to mouth, you know, trying to make ends meet, who don't even have a choice of coming up the corporate ladder, and yet are doing the same work of rearing kids and going to the office every day or whatever the workplace is. And I think that one thing that can help bring people together and sort of focus people in an ethical way and an uplifting way is to reach out and lend them a hand as well. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it's a response. I guess what I was really getting at is that I think women tend to make men more circumscribed to things because they have that sense of caring, and I think it's the mother, if you will, in them. And to see some of that kind of going to the wayside, because I find, as I said, in corporate America, I find some of the brightest women, they kind of put on that same male role, and they lose that sensitivity that I think the women that you wrote about had.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, one of the things that, and as I've said, I mean, these women all just personally resonate with me. There may be women who've done incredible things that that have, you know, willingly gone into a more sort of male cast, you know, if you will. But all of these women were very, very much found strength in their femininity, and I hope that will be the case going forward. I mean, I think a lot of younger women, you know, are bombarded with these images of female power being about, you know, being thin and glamorous and sort of sexually promiscuous. And I found, you know, a lot of comfort in looking at these women who saw their power in, you know, as you pointed out, being maternal in some way, being so strong as women, but with a feminine strength that was extremely dignified. And this is, you know, my effort to kind of spotlight that and try to emulate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Don't you think, though, I don't know, maybe it's my limited experience with men that I know that I work with or that I know outside the workplace, but there's a lot of caregiving being done by men. It's maybe not quite 50-50 yet, but it has changed a great deal. I know that here at work, if a family, if a husband has a newborn at home, he will take advantage of, you know, parental leave.
Mm-hmm. So, well, certainly there's a lot of caregiving being done by my husband while I'm on the book tour. So, I think that is important to recognize.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really healthy. But you know, while we recognize and very much honor that, and hopefully make sure there's no stigma about it, I think we also have to be honest that still there it's quite largely in the hands of women around the country, and you know, I just think that it's just important not to brush it under the rug. You know, it's
sure.
Sort of, child care can just be so invisible to people, and yet it's incredibly hard work and very important work.
Yeah. Also elder care.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And there's so many people who are doing both at the same time.
Right.
And working hard to make ends meet. And I think we would, you know, we could just be much more civilized as a country if we prioritized it a bit more in terms of, you know, people sort of say when I mention Head Start funding or, you know, money for early childhood education and daycare, oh, well, everybody's for that. And you know, the truth is that although people may be rhetorically for it, it's the first thing on the chopping block in a budget situation. And I think that that the more people who were engaged and paid attention to that, then would be the better in terms of writing our course.
Hmm. How did the women in that you profile, how did they juggle work with raising families? You mentioned that some of these women really didn't get going really out there until they were older. But how did they juggle work and raising families?
Well, you know, it really varied. And I think that that's a lesson in and of itself, that one size doesn't fit all and never has. But there were only two women in the book who didn't face that challenge of balancing their family and their work. And in Alice Hamilton's case, it's because she never married and never had children. And I think it was a very conscious choice, and she almost saw her work as a sort of a priesthood in a way. And for Mother Jones, it was the result of a terrible tragedy where she lost her husband and all four of her children to a yellow fever epidemic early on in her life, which I think had quite a transformative effect on her. But of the others, it varied quite a bit. Some had really supportive husbands, really loving marriages, and that made all the difference. That was the case for Ida B. Wells Barnett and also for Virginia Durr. Others really had it was such a challenge, and actually, you know, there were losses and there were setbacks, and there were there were things that I think they would have wished had gone otherwise. But I guess one example, Dolores Huerta, who raised 11 children while organizing farm workers, is one of the most extreme examples. And she really, like a lot of other women in this book, relied a great deal on extended family and on friends. And I think for me, looking at that model, at grandparents and mothers-in-law involved, is very healthy in some ways.
Mm. These women are heroic, but they are also, or they were, human beings. How do you view their flaws? And did you come away with any new insight into our failings as human beings, our limits?
Well, I really did want to paint portraits that were very full and showed flaws and weaknesses as well as strengths, because we're all human, and I think that it's much more healthy to see that people who aren't perfect can be heroic, and not to put our leaders on a pedestal and say, you know, and then just wait for them to be knocked off. I really wanted to show that, and I think that in some ways what I came away with, I mean, for instance, Ida B. Wells, incredible woman, had a temper. She knew it herself. She alienated a lot of people in her day because of that. And she was just uncompromising. She would, if she disagreed with somebody, she would just go up and argue with them forcefully, even if the situation didn't call for it. So, but then again, look at what she accomplished as a single black woman in the Deep South. She was exposing lynching, going to the scene of the crime, and I guess I come away thinking about their flaws and weaknesses, and in general, sort of, I suppose, the human condition, as about really about empathy in a way. I mean, seeing the best in each other as people, coming together and trying to make the world better, is just a much happier place to be than the infighting that I think often destroys very good causes. So I guess I come away thinking that we should be more forgiving of each other.
Yeah, and look at one another from the outset with, you know, maybe a little bit of try and put aside our preconceptions. And here maybe this would be a nice point to ask you to tell a story about meeting Gretchen Buchenholz.
Oh, yes. The last chapter, chapter 9, is about Gretchen Buchenholz, who is a child advocate working in New York City today. And when I was working at a law firm, this was after the 2000 election, and I had the opportunity to practice law, which I very much enjoyed, but I was just sort of drawn back into, I suppose, politics, public service, maybe. I went to work at a nonprofit called Association to Benefit Children. And the reason why I did that was because I was introduced to Gretchen Buchenholz, and I was just so totally charmed by her. She's somebody who, although she's extremely firm in standing up for the most vulnerable people, really, homeless children, children with disabilities, and their families, she is also just very kind and forgiving, and I think that her personal style is in a way responsible for a lot of her success. And she's created programs that have been replicated around the country, model programs, as well as raised awareness about issues like AIDS, pediatric AIDS, asthma, which is really epidemic among poor children, and mental health. She's really behind kind of that campaign to reduce the stigma about mental illness. So I admire her a great deal, and I'm glad to end the book with her.
Yeah. And by way of summing up here, any last thought you want to share with us about the value of public service?
Well, I guess I would like to say thank you so much for having me on, and I'm so happy to have received such thoughtful questions. And I want to just close by saying that that I think now more than ever we really need people to be called to public service. It doesn't mean you got to throw your hat in the ring and run for office. I think it just means that looking out for needs that are going unaddressed, and it could be in healthcare, it could be in protecting the environment. But and I certainly am not perfect on this front at all. I'm trying to challenge myself more. But I think that if we all come together, people may look back in 100 years and say, okay, you know, they got it right. They corrected course, and are, we're better off as Americans for it. And so that's what I hope for.
Mm. Corinna, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Corinna Gore-Schiff has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Lighting the Way, 9 Women Who Changed America. The book is published. It's a Miramax book, and it is published by Hyperion. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Tom Rogers.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm filling in for Todd Gleason and Dave Dickey, who are out at our all-day Ag Outlook show at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana, just across the border, and should be about to head home after a long day of analysis and good fellowship at that event going on today, the Ag Outlook, all day long. Coming back to our current day's trade on the Chicago Board of Trade, we saw a fairly mixed wheat market, everything else lower. Corn continues its slide on bearish news, very little news actually, but continued concerns about bird flu and improved Midwest weather conditions. The soybeans down in the 8 to 9 cent range, and as mentioned, the wheat sort of mixed, as any bearish news is being countered by concerns about dry weather out in the hard red winter wheat belt. Let's start with the Kansas City wheat contracts. The March wheat had a high today of 440 a bushel, the low 443. It settled at the low for the day, 433. 433 was the low. And the settlement, the change down 2 3/4 on the day in the March wheat. July had a high today of 449.5. At the low of 440.5, settled at 442. That was down 1. Now to the Board of Trade in Chicago. March wheat had a high today of 375, the low 369.5. It settled at 370.5. It was up a half on the day. Actually, the wheat contract surprised a few observers by starting the day on the open up a little bit. And some of them kept that strength going. And we had one contract ending down on the day, but the rest sort of flat to a penny higher. The May contract in wheat had a high of 385.25 today, the low 378. It settled at 381. That was up 1 penny. July wheat had a high of 396, the low 389. The settlement 392. That was up a half. September wheat, the low down contract today in the wheat pit. The high in September was 405.5, the low 399.5, settled at 402, down a quarter. December wheat, the high 418.75, the low 412. It settled at 415.25, up 3/4. Now the down markets, the corn for March at a high today of 224, the low 220.75, and it settled just over 220 a bushel at 221. That was down 2 cents on the day. The May contract, 233.75, the low 230.25. It settled at 230.5, down 2.25. July corn had a high today of 243.75, the low of 240.5. The settlement price there, 240.75, down 2.25 on the day. The September contract had a high of 251 a bushel, the low 248. It settled at 248.25, down 1. December corn had a high of 260.75, the low 257.25, settled at 257.75, down 1.75. And March of 07 corn today had a high of 267.25, the low 264.25, settled at 264.75, down 1. In the oats, the May or the March contract rather had a high of 185, the low 183.25, settled at 183.25, the low for the day, down 0.75. May had a high of 189, the low 186.75. It settled at 188.75, up 1.25 cents. Now on to the beans. Another day of losses in the bean pit. March had a high of 592, the low 578. Settled at the low for the day, 578, the nearby contract, down 9 cents. May beans at a high of 603, the low 589, settled at 590, down 10.5 cents. July beans, the high $6.14.5, the low $6.5. Settled at $6.01.5, down 10. August beans, the high today $6.17, the low $6.05, settled at the low $6.05, down 11. September, the high $6.12, the low $6.07, settled at $6.07, down 9.5. November beans, at a high of $6.24, the low $6.12.5, settled at $6.14, down 8.5. And January of next year's bean contract had a high of $6.29, the low $6.18, settled at $6.20, down 9. Now to the products. Soybean meal for March at a high of $174.70, the low of $171.80, the settlement $172.50, down $140. May beans at a high of $176.70, the low $173.70, settled at $174.30, down $160. And bean oil for March at a high of $24.46, the low $23.88, settled at $23.95, down 50 cents. And the May had a high of $24.84. The low $24.20, that settlement was $24.31, and that was down 48. A reminder, since Todd and Dave and many of the rest of our analysts are at today's All-Day Ag Outlook, Todd Gleason put together a special edition of the Closing Market Report, which you'll be able to hear at 2:06 Eastern Time, or Central Time, rather, this afternoon, 3:06 Eastern. And we'll get the analysis as well from L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana, as well as some features that Todd put together before attending today's event. Now let's go to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange with those numbers. Celeste Quinn.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. It was another lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, the high 106.20, the low 104.60, the settlement 104.70, that down 125. April, the high 107.40, the low 106.05, the settlement 106.20, that down 75. May feeder cattle 108.10, the high 107 even, the low 107.40, the settlement, that down 47.5. April live cattle 85.90, the high 84.70, the low 84.77.5, the settlement, that down 92.5. June live cattle 81.47.5, the high 80.35, the low 80.37.5, the settlement, that down 90. April lean hogs, today's high 60.50, the low 58.87.5, the settlement 59.40, that down 137.5. May 67.80, the high 66.70, the low 67.25, the settlement, that down 80. June 69.15, the high 67.95, the low 68.65, the settlement, then off 87.5. July lean hogs 68.20, the high, the low 67.15, the settlement 67.85, that finishing down 77.5. And March pork bellies, today's high 87.80, the low 86.50, the settlement 87.10, that down 110. The Dow is up 4 points at 10,962. The NASDAQ off 20 at 2266. The S&P 500 is off 4 points at 1274. Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit